Unstoppable Sound Agency.
Welcome to this edition of Move to Amend Reports, where we connect you with activists and organizers working on the front lines of the democracy movement to bring you the lowdown on corporate rule, corporate personhood, and money as speech. This is a space to find info you need to help pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy. I'm Egberto Willis, and
I'm Laura Bonham. How are you doing, Egberto?
Well, now that I'm with you guys, I am doing great. You know, I had a great time out there at Netroots Nation 2016. Went great. We had a great march with Black Lives Matter. We shut down the central freeway that went through this town. And the day before, we also had a march throughout the city. We actually tore it down.
Very cool. And without opening an entire can of worms, were you there when Clinton announced her support for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United?
Of course. That was done by video. She wasn't in town, but she did it by video. And, you know, folks were excited. Most of the folks think it's all about Citizens United. Here at Move to Amend, we know better. And that's the message that we were pushing out there. Those of us from Move to Amend that were out there, and there are quite a few people that have some sort of relationship with Move to Amend, and they were out there explaining to folks that Citizens United is just the first baby step in the entire process.
Yeah, well, that's a way to go, and it shows we still have some work to do. That's why we exist. So anyway, moving along, we've got a great show today. We talk with student activist and Black Lives Matter organizer Elsa LeCue about the intersections between the movements for racial justice and democracy. But first, we'll get started with some news.
Absolutely, Laura. In reflecting on George H.W. Bush's presidency, Ralph Nader once said it made him wax nostalgic for Ronald Reagan. Looking at the spectacle in Cleveland where the RNC is staging its national convention, I, too, am waxing nostalgic for Reagan's GOP. That said, this beautiful little story unfolded. Photographer Spencer Tunick gathered 100 women of various shapes, sizes, and colors to be part of a live art installation he had planned over the last 3 years, entitled Everything She Says Means Everything. Tunick staged a photo shoot in Cleveland on Sunday, July 17th, across from the Quicken Loans Arena, where the RNC convention is taking place. The women stripped naked, and then each woman held up to the sunrise a circular mirror, which obscured their faces with reflections of the world around them. Tunick hoped the work would serve as an act of peaceful protest, combating the hateful rhetoric Donald Trump and his followers have directed at women through the simple power of what? Collective creation. Over 1,800 women applied to be part of the project. Meanwhile, on Monday, July 18th, over at the RNC convention, the Women Vote Trump event drew 17 participants, including the paid interns and journalists who attended. One person commented that the Q&A consisted of panelists asking each other questions since so few were in attendance. On the outside of the convention, there are at least 1,800 women willing to appear nude in public to protest Trump's and the GOP misogyny. But on the inside of the convention, they couldn't even get 18 women with their clothes on to show up. The GOP is certainly reaping what it has sown.
The People's Peace and Justice Convention convened in Cleveland this past weekend ahead of the opening of the RNC convention with the goal to create a people's platform. in a city under a security assault by law enforcement, beholden to the elite and powerful and bent on preventing violence when their mere presence incites it. And in answer to the GOP and its hate mongering and pandering to wealthy and corporate issues, the People's Peace and Justice Convention provided a space for voices to be heard in seeking solutions to the many issues U.S. citizens and her residents face. The American Friends Service Committee, Hip Hop Caucus, Code Pink, Northeast Ohio Industrial Workers of the World, Organize Ohio, Peace in the Hood, Sierra Club, and Move to Amend were just a few of the organizations involved. Discussions revolved around democracy issues, the economy, the environment, war and peace, among others. Building solidarity across issues and communities was a priority among all the participants. In a two-day marathon session, convention goers drew up myriad platform points and ratified the platform through direct participatory democracy. The People's Platform itself will be submitted to both the Republican and Democratic parties, and it provides a list of demands for the burgeoning democracy movement to support as we move forward. But equally important as the platform itself, the process employed to achieve the result was purely democratic in nature. A democracy isn't just what we live in, or used to anyway, but it is active participation in the decisions communities make. If nothing else, this convention proves that people of diverse backgrounds can come together and create mutually beneficial policies for all, rather than exclusive policies that only benefit corporations and their wealthy owners and shareholders. The political revolution, the democracy movement, is well underway.
Absolutely, absolutely. Look, on Monday, July 18th in Chicago, Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa of the 35th Ward said the following. Today, the Republicans are kicking off their hate fest in Ohio, where we will have people like Donald Trump and his minions spew all types of anti-immigrant rhetoric. But here in Chicago, we are fighting back. Immigrant leaders in the Windy City are asking Chicago leadership to step up on its promise to make Chicago the most immigrant-friendly city in the U.S. by amending the Welcome City Ordinance passed back in 2012. According to the Chicago Sun-Times, quote, the proposed amendment would prohibit city employees, including police officers, from threatening deportation or questioning immigration status of anyone or a family, redefine comments or threats based on someone's immigration status as verbal abuse, or coercion in some cases, and update the ordinance language that is archaic and inconsistent with its original purpose. These changes will help to foster trust between the city and immigrant communities by ensuring immigrants can confidently engage with city agencies without the fear of deportation, end quote. While this is a positive development, it's important to remember that being in the U.S. without current and accurate documents is a civil offense, not a crime, and that anyone, not just U.S. citizens, within U.S. borders is protected by the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights. The widely used term illegal immigrant is political in nature and employed to divide communities from one another and against one another so the 1% can rule over the 99%. By criminalizing undocumented people, many of whom are in the process of obtaining documents, voters blame those seeking the simple necessities of life rather than the economic, environmental, and social policies that feed and exacerbate immigration without documentation. Look, Move to Amend supports this effort by Chicago's immigrant communities and the fear and equitable streaming of the immigration process while opposing the free trade deals responsible for this exodus from Mexico and points further south.
Coming up next, we have a conversation with Elsa LeCue of Black Lives Matters, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, about the intersections between racial justice and democracy movements. We'll get the ball rolling after a quick public service announcement.
Help raise awareness about the movement to amend the Constitution by hosting your own House Party for Democracy. Invite family, friends, and neighbors for a screening of our mini-documentary, Legalize Democracy. To find the film and learn how to get started with your house party, visit movetoamend.org/houseparties. That's one word, movetoamend.org/houseparties.
You're listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we bring you the voices from the movement to amend the Constitution and abolish corporate rule.
Some of our listeners were lucky enough to be in attendance at a panel discussion featuring Jacqueline Patterson, Ambar Pinto, and our guest on this edition of Move to Amend Reports, Elsa LeCue. The topic was building relationships across issues and movements, something in which Move to Amend is actively involved. For this episode, we welcome Elsa LeCue, who rose to prominence through the Black Lives Matter movement in Maryland and Washington, D.C., to discuss the intersectionality of issues across communities. Elsa LeCue is a student activist born in Gondar, Ethiopia. She came to America with her mother. In high school, she became active within her community of Montgomery County, Maryland. And through her activism, she saw firsthand the impact of empowering youth to be more politically active and how that fortifies the future of what American democracy could look like. Shortly after entering into Howard University, Elsa became active within the Black Lives Matter movement, organizing and aiding in the fight for police accountability legislation in Maryland. Elsa is a senior at Howard University studying political science and economics. It's great to have you on the show, Elsa.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, you guys.
Elsa, it's wonderful having you with us. This is great. Now, because this show is on intersectionality, we don't want to dwell on specific organizations per se, but we really can't have that discussion without understanding more about your work with Black Lives Matter. So, could you please tell us what drove a Howard University student to organize a New Year's Day die-in at a Maryland shopping mall?
The thing that kind of sparked my activism was the shooting death of Michael Brown. And actually, it was attending Howard University that was definitely a big spark for me also, because being around and being surrounded by Black folks who were just frustrated of this continual onslaught killing of Black people and there being no justice or accountability for it. I remember the night that we heard that Michael Brown's police officer who ended up taking his life would just be released with impunity. It was heartbreaking, and we marched from Howard University to the White House, and I think that was definitely my first kind of call to action to organize within my community, because I didn't see anyone organizing around the Wheaton, Silver Spring area, and I just felt the need to, you know, if a Black woman isn't going to do it, who else would have said? So I ended up getting involved. And I did it with another sister of mine by the name of Miriam. She was in high school at the time, actually. And we both organized this first demonstration. And it was honestly, without the help of activists from D.C., from Virginia, the DMV area, Erica Totten, all of this would have never really been able to come forth. So that's why I started organizing within my respective communities, because I didn't see anybody else bringing this issue or bringing this conversation to the Montgomery County area.
Now, when you got it all put together, did you get any kind of pushback, whether it's officially or unofficially?
Oh, absolutely. There was definitely, you know, some pushback in regards to, oftentimes the phrases that I'd hear when I was organizing that demonstration is, you know, police accountability, police brutality, that's not really an issue here in Maryland. Why are you bringing it here? It's a Ferguson issue. It's a Florida issue. It's a Baton Rouge issue. But really, Maryland police definitely don't really have a lot of oversight in a sense. There definitely needs to be change right here at my local level of Montgomery County and Maryland police at large. So there was some pushback in regards to even some of my peers, and there was also some pushback in regards to mall police and mall management and the local Montgomery County police here also. But at the end of the day, whenever you face any type of opposition, it's expected, and you just have to push back and look forward. So,
excellent. Now, when you do these types of demonstrations, I know that Black Lives Matter is a decentralized organization. Do you kind of pull input in from other folks? I noticed you earlier said you got some help from some of the folks in D.C. Did you kind of pull in from other parts of the country as well, people with the type of experience that know how to deal with the cops if necessary, know how to deal with institutions if necessary?
For the most part, I just reached out to local activists around my area for help and, you know, for mentorship and guidance and what to do. But it was definitely more of a local effort than outreach somewhere outside of Maryland or anything like that.
You mentioned something telling in that you said if you as a Black university student didn't organize this event in your community, then nobody would. So it sounds to me like this was your first venture into this kind of activism. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I definitely stuck to, for the most part, because in high school, that's all I knew. I just became politically active in terms of just canvassing and working for political organizations. But when the Black Lives Matter movement started, that's when I knew that in seeing other brothers and sisters around my age organize demonstrations and protests and marches, I figured, why couldn't I do that as well? And that was definitely my first venture into organizing, you know, firsthand.
And that's a great lesson to learn. Thanks for doing it.
Of course. It was definitely much easier than I thought. Honestly, you just have to set up a Facebook page and invite a couple of friends, and then they invite their friends. So it's all good. Yeah.
How many people did you get in attendance the first time?
Around 90 or 80 people.
Wow.
Yeah, trust me. I was surprised myself, because when I showed up, I was like, are you guys here to shop? Or are you here for the demonstration? It was a wonderful surprise at the end of the day. Yeah.
So would you say to folks who have never participated in something like that or done something like that, that the hardest part is actually just taking the first step?
Absolutely. In all honesty, it's taking the first step to become active and to just, you know, when I talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, it's a movement that is mainly on social media. And when you utilize social media in order to organize, that's something that actually benefited me the most. So that's the first piece of advice that I would give, is to just go ahead and just do it. Yeah.
So now Black Lives Matter is only part of what you do. You are also organized within the LGBTQ Ethiopian community, and both communities share common ground in the battle for civil rights, but across the board are pretty much seen as wholly separate. Would you describe the work that you've been doing within that community and how you bridge the issues to bring the communities together?
Well, for the most part, I definitely do believe that activism, it comes in so many different forms, but first and foremost, it's always about sparking a conversation that needs to be had. And oftentimes the reason why there's such dispute in regards to, what do you mean Black Lives Matter? Don't all lives matter? Well, of course they do. But the thing is, Black lives have to matter in order for all lives to eventually matter. So in regards to working with in trying to advocate more for the LGBTQ community, and in also my just journey in its own in trying to understand some of the causes, some of their demands, what I mainly have to do within my respective community and within my life is to engage in conversations within, you know, my dinner table, across my Habesha community, and trying to get them to understand that more than anything, the thing that divides us is much smaller than the thing that actually brings us together, and in that we're all humans and we deserve to have our civil rights and civil liberties protected.
And do you feel like you're making headway? I mean, that's not quick work. That's building relationships and doing.
No, it's most certainly not. Yeah.
So
trust me, growing up within a Christian Orthodox household, I definitely received much more pushback within my dinner table than anything else. So at the end of the day, like my mentor oftentimes tells me, the struggle is eternal. And as long as we're able to fortify those conversations that just needs to be had, then we can eventually make some sort of headway. Yeah.
Well, that's good advice. Thanks for sharing that.
We'll continue this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
Does your elected representative support amending the Constitution to end corporate constitutional rights and get money out of politics? You can help us find out by joining Move to Amend's Pledge to Amend campaign. Help persuade local, state, and federal legislators to pledge support for our We the People amendment. Recruit co-sponsors for this amendment in the U.S. House and Senate. For more information, visit movetoamend.org/pledge-amend. That's movetoamend.org/pledge-amend.
Are you part of a faith or ethical community whose values and principles are being violated by corporate actions? We, the people of the Move to Amend Interfaith Caucus, share in common a variety of values and principles. In this unity, we find the short-sighted and single-minded drive for profits by certain corporations has led to the degradation of the environment and our society. Corporate power has come to dominate our existence, with the values and principles we all hold dear being routinely violated by powerful corporations using their so-called personhood to influence elections, legislation, regulations, and judicial outcomes in their favor and at our expense. It is the purpose of the Interfaith Caucus to engage faith and ethical communities and educate about how the work of ending corporate rule can be approached from a spiritual, ethical, or religious perspective. Working together at national, state, local, and faith community levels, we can pass the We the People Amendment. Join us on our monthly calls the third Wednesday of each month at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit movetoamend.org/interfaith-caucus for more information.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we connect the dots between the current issues of our time and the nature of corporate rule. We're talking with Elsa LePue of Black Lives Matter DMV about the intersections between racial justice and democracy. Elsa, the recent killings in Baton Rouge, St. Paul, and Dallas are tragedies in their own ways and are undoubtedly on many people's hearts and minds right now, not least of which communities of color who have been speaking to police brutality and racial injustice for generations. Jesse Williams recently spoke to this struggle at the BET Awards saying, quote, "We know that police somehow manage to de-escalate, disarm, and not kill white people every day. So what is going to happen is we are going to have equal rights and justice in our own country, or we will restructure their function and ours." Please share with us your thoughts to what Jesse means in this statement.
I honestly can't. Every single time I hear that statement as a whole, it definitely does bring me goosebumps, because that is exactly how I would describe the Black Lives Matter movement. It is that what's going to happen, when he said what's going to happen is we are going to have equal rights and justice in our country, or we will restructure their function and ours. And oftentimes, that's actually exactly what I believe the Black Lives Matter movement is. Whenever you see us protest or demonstrate or march, that is us restructuring our function in order for our demands to be met at the end of the day. And when Jesse Williams was talking about how officers are able to disarm white individuals who have guns, who are actually being much more violent, you know, in situations with cops, how they're able to do that. But then again, in Baton Rouge, we saw at close range a black man get shot 4 times. There are definitely injustices across this country that needs to be met. And I'm really glad that he said that.
One of the things that I'm really glad he said it too. I think it's a beautiful and powerful statement. And what we will restructure their function and ours, that to me is a lot of what the work that Move to Amend does in terms of trying to create a functioning democracy for all people and not for corporations and just wealthy white folks. So restructuring the Constitution by amending it to create a level playing field is part of it from which a transformative democracy can go. So when I see restructuring function in ours, and I look at what Black Lives Matter is doing, particularly trying to work within the system legislatively to create laws and a rule of law where everybody is treated fairly, to create police accountability and so forth, it's really a beautiful thing. Unfortunately, the media will pounce on a statement like that and use it to strike fear into the hearts of racist white folks.
Right. Certainly, we've seen the result of what fear-mongering can do, because that's exactly what the Trump campaign has successfully built, you know, its foundation on, is fear-mongering as a whole, is that, you know, all these supposed Mexicans are going to come into our country and they're all rapists. And those generalizations as a whole is what is fortifying his campaign in order to become president of these United States. And it's actually scary. And it shows us there is such a huge divide in regards to conversations about sex, about race, about foreign immigrants. And there are just so many conversations that we need to have as a whole. I believe that's the thing that what his presidency has definitely been able to ensure for me is that there are so many more conversations that need to be had within our respective communities.
I imagine it was a bit of a shocker for you when you walked in to Move to Amend National Leadership Summit and encountered an ocean of predominantly old white faces. So I hope you felt the respect the audience had for you and the other speakers. Now, when it was all said and done, we decided that panel discussion was one of the best that we've ever had. So after your experience with us, do you see the intersections between Move to Amend and the organizations you work with?
Absolutely. I definitely see much more commonality, especially when I was in that room as a whole. Yes, I remember when I was being briefed about the conference, about how I was going to come and represent the Black Lives Matter movement, and I was going to talk to a majority audience that was white. I was like, wow, you guys are really throwing me to the wolves, aren't you? But when I got there, it was a conversation that I felt that everyone was welcome in terms of them wanting to have the conversation. They were definitely welcome and open to a lot of my perspective. And that was something that I really appreciated, because I feel like for the most part, the reason why a lot of white Americans avoid having these conversations about race, about money within politics is, you know, if I have too much money, you clearly want to take it away from me. Or what is white privilege? I've grown up poor for most of my life. What privilege are you talking about? So in terms of kind of like that perspective, I felt like when I walked into that room, it was an audience that felt the need that there was a gap within our society as a whole in regards to classism and race, and they were open to having that. And I'm glad that I, you know, walked out feeling much more inspired than I kind of like did coming in. Yeah.
Now, how did you find the questions that they had to ask you? Did you think they were present? Were they showing, let's say, what's a word that I want to use? Did they give you any sort of impression that they didn't necessarily believe the way you were expressing different issues, or did you feel like they wanted to learn from you?
I felt like the audience definitely did want to learn more so than anything else. Yeah.
Okay. Does our vision of passing the We the People Amendment so we can finally establish a democracy that works for all people, not just white ones and definitely not corporations, connect to the issues faced by the communities in which you work?
Absolutely. Because we've seen time and time again that the current system that is currently in place obviously has not been working. Otherwise, everything that has been going on in regards to police accountability and injustices that have been going on in regards to police shootings and killings, and how our justice system continues to be blind and impartial to white folks as opposed to Black people or people of color or other marginalized groups is the reason why a lot of this madness is kind of ensuing. So I definitely believe that the campaign of We the People definitely does fortify movements such as the Black Lives Matter movements that are trying to advocate more so, you know, on the side of people of color, marginalized folks, than white people in general.
Now, this is sort of a jump around because I asked it before, but I want to kind of put a little bit more perspective to it. Earlier on, we had discussed offline about how do you actually engage your white friends, what we normally call allies, to the movement. I was on a call last night at Cuff Party USA where we were very concerned about the current things that are happening both in Baton Rouge, in Minnesota, and Dallas. And I think I was the only Black person on the call. And what I found is that there were quite a few of these people interested in hearing how can they help. And one of the things that I explained, and I want to hear your take on this and what other things you tell allies. I told them bluntly, there are two things that we really need. One is your bodies. We need your bodies out there The reason we need your bodies is, believe it or not, your bodies provide security for a lot of folks in these movements.
And absolutely.
Right. And secondly, the other thing I said was you need to ensure that you are able to be just as uncomfortable as anybody else and not use discomfort as a reason not to engage those not like you. What else would you add to that?
Well, I mean, that's such a perfect answer as a whole. When I remember when I was in Baltimore, there were a lot of ally members when we were met with national security trying to cut us off at certain roads and stuff like that, that they ended up, you know, leaving. And I feel like that's something that is so convenient. And that is an inherent white privilege that I don't think that they really recognize, is that we have no other choice but to continue protests and marching on behalf of our Black brothers and sisters. Because once we are silenced, once we stop marching, once we start protesting, is when this violence is going to continue. So I would definitely, you know, emphasize the point that you made in regard to continuing to, you know, please just march. Definitely march alongside us if you are an ally, and continue to support the movement in that, you know, you march alongside us. You don't get scared. You have to be just as uncomfortable as we are, like you said. And what I would add on to that is oftentimes something that is very simple but oftentimes neglected when it comes to talking about what makes a good ally is you just have to listen to us. You have to try and just you know, not really take the mic from us, in that you are able to just sit down and listen to our problems, because trust me, we can definitely describe most often, you know, what it means to be Black in America, but it's not really something that can be understood from a white perspective. So definitely march alongside us, and first and foremost, just listen, and most certainly do not take the mic. Be willing to pass on the mic whenever conversations about Blackness or marginalization or such topics like those pop up, because we can definitely speak on our own behalf, on our own experiences.
Excellent.
That's excellent advice. And not just for when you're talking, not for just when you're in communities of color or marginalized community, but in general. Especially right. Important in those communities, but in general, important to listen and not judge. Thank you.
Absolutely. And if I can just add on to that one more, because oftentimes whenever we talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, we forget other marginalized groups such as women or LGBT members. I think that that counts the same as a cisgendered man. If there's a question about the LGBT community, you can definitely feel free to give up your seat for an LGBT member of our community in order for them to speak on their behalf too. It really goes either ways. When we talk about allies, I'm an ally in regards to the LGBT struggle. I'm here for them when they need me, but I definitely have to understand and check my privilege whenever, since I am, you know, straight woman, I can definitely pass on the mic whenever, you know, a member of my community who is LGBT wants to speak up on their behalf. Yeah.
A lot of what you said to me reminds me very much of the golden rule. Mm. And that, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which seems to me, if the Constitution of the United States were modeled more after the golden rule than after protecting property rights, we wouldn't be having this discussion at all. So let's move to a
You're right about that.
yeah. But it isn't. And we are here to talk about these issues so that we can make it be more that way.
Laura, I just want to make one clarification and see if Elsa agrees, because for our listeners, I think it's important. When we say pass the mic, or in that regard, in the way that a lot of us have done things in the activist world, is pass the mic when you have that feeling of assertion, but keep the mic if what you have are questions from what you have are questions. Hold that mic because we want to make sure that you are informed. And your thoughts right. on that. In other words, a lot of our listeners, when they hear pass the mic, they think it really means just sit down and be quiet even if they have questions?
Oh, absolutely not. Questions are definitely encouraged. And I think I probably said this before, but I'm not sure if I got it out as clearly as I wanted to. But when I say pass the mic, it's mainly, for example, if there was an all white man panel and a police accountability question ended up popping up, and it was in regards to blackness, about how black people are perceived, I would give up my mic to a black man or to a black woman in order for them to speak on their experiences. That's what I mean when I say pass the mic. If it's not in regards to your experiences, don't speak on their behalf. That's what I'm trying to emphasize. But most certainly, you know, pick up the mic if you do have a question. That's definitely encouraged, because oftentimes the reason why people are so scared to talk about race in this country is because they fear that they're going to be perceived as a racist. Right. And we all have certain biases that we most certainly need to check. I mean, there are certain thoughts that I think most of the general population have that is definitely problematic, but we don't realize that it's problematic because we've grown up with those thoughts either in our families or it was fortified by our educational system and so forth. So when it comes to, you know, picking up the mic, absolutely do. You know, feel free to ask that question if you are in a safe space to do so. And if not, then just reach out to a fellow brother or sister or any member of a particular group that, you know, you might have a question for. Yeah.
Excellent.
I think that kind of gets around to intersectionality again and working in what intersectionality is, which are, you know, being the points where different communities share common ground.
Absolutely.
But part of working at intersectionality is being able to identify when you are actually at an intersection. And I think what you described there really is an intersection when you are in these positions and there are people who have lived experiences compared to your knowledge of other people's experiences. You're at an intersection. You have a choice where you can allow, you know, give that person room to speak, or you can yammer on.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. Exactly.
And so let's talk about intersectionality some more and how a lot of your work focuses there. So do you find how does your work at this point manifest itself? Because working at these intersections is a long-term process of finding common ground, I would imagine. And the next question is the more common ground you find enable you to find even more common ground?
Absolutely. When it comes to, for example, blackness, whether you're a black woman, a black man, or an LGBT member and black, all of those things, the one fabric that definitely does tie us together is that we are all black. And no matter how, you know, how many times you want to try and ignore it, there's a possibility that in this country, being black is definitely a threat in terms of when engaged with police, because we have seen black girls such as Ayanna Jones, black boys such as Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, black men, and Sandra Bland, Rakia Boyd, you name it. When it comes to our blackness, that is the one kind of like fabric that ties us together. And understanding that this movement for Black Lives Matter is not just for black men or black boys, even though that is what the media oftentimes chooses to highlight, it is recognizing that blackness in any regard, in any respect, is definitely seen as a sort of a threat. So working alongside different intersections and different marginalized groups, it's coming to this understanding that no matter who you are, whether you are cisgendered, whether you are a woman, whether you are a man, that this fight is to fortify all black people and all marginalized groups. And in trying to understand just overall that we definitely have much more in common than we have in our differences. Yes.
How do you manage the struggle, overcome objections, or are you still in more preliminary stages?
More preliminary stages, I would say. But like I said before, activism definitely begins at a conversation level, because sometimes when we I remember the hashtag Black Women's Lives Matter or All Black Lives Matter came up. There were some men that definitely came out in objection saying, oh, is it because you think Black women are more important than Black men, or that members of the LGBT community are much more important than cisgender people? And that is not the case at all. But that is actually something, interestingly enough, that has happened when the Black Lives Matter movement kind of like came about. But what about all Black, you know, but what about all lives instead of just Black lives? It's not just that. We have to understand that there are different intersections and there are different levels of oppression when it comes to, you know, yes, there is racism, but what about being a Black woman, you know, in regards to sexism and racism as a whole? There are different intersections that need to be addressed instead of just one way, because when we focus on this lane of fighting for just Black men as a whole, we're not doing justice. You know, when I remember when Barack Obama ended up coming up with the program My Brother's Keeper, there were some critics of it that were saying, you know, what about My Sister's Keeper? There are definitely Black girls that also need mentorship within low-income communities, just girls in general who need, you know, the sort of aid that Black boys also need. So when it comes to intersectionality, it's about including everybody under the same umbrella. And it is recognizing that we have much more alike than we have, you know, in terms of our differences. And we should definitely fight for all Black people instead of just one particular group of what Blackness is.
So true. So true. Elsa, you are a first-generation U.S. citizen of Ethiopian descent. How has that experience shaped your ideology, advocacy, and activism?
That's a fantastic question. My mentor kind of asked me the same thing, and honestly, the best answer that I could come up for that is, historically, Ethiopian people have been able to, there's a sort of privilege that I believe Ethiopian people have in the regard of, historically, we have become a sovereign nation. My activism, I see it as an example of me paying back my ancestors for them fighting for my ability to, you know, say that I haven't gone through a lot of the tragedies that that other African nations have definitely gone through. In that regard, is to continue their fight for freedom, because even though to a certain degree we might be slightly more liberated, there's definitely the fight for liberation still continues on. So that's how I see my activism, is that I have this debt to pay, and this my activism is hopefully my way of paying back my ancestors for fighting for me and for my country.
Now, how old were you when you came over here?
Oh, I was only about 5 years old.
Okay, got it. Now, as far as, do you remember the culture shock when you came, or did you live within an Ethiopian community that sort of minimized the shock?
There was, you know, to a certain degree, like any other foreigner would experience, there was definitely culture shock. I think for the most part, when Ethiopians think about America, we see this as a safe haven of equality for all, and you know, all men are created equal under the law. And when I came here, it was definitely a huge cultural shock when I saw exactly the level of not only racism, but colorism within the Black community, being called an Oreo, not really understanding exactly what that was. I was like, oh, is this a real thing? I thought, it's understanding, like I said before, when it comes to intersectionality, it's about understanding these different level of struggles and how eventually I can try and fight to help my Habesha community or my community at large learn from those experiences and grow from it. So, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
Well, you are being a great role model for young women in your community, and I certainly hope they reap the benefits of your reinvestment in democracy in the United States, because it needs all the help it can get.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
But at any rate, Because, you know, unfortunately, not to the too distant futures, we're all setting examples for other people. Hopefully we'll have been good role models for them. And you obviously are. So anyway, we're almost out of time. So what final comments would you like to leave with our listeners? And please let folks know how they can get involved with Black Lives Matter and take action within their own communities.
Honestly, Black Lives Matter was a movement that started on social media. That's how I personally found out about it. And I just set up a Facebook page and 80 to 90 people ended up coming to my first demonstration. That isn't so much more to brag. That's not what it is, but it's just to encourage anyone else that might be listening to encourage them that you can do this too. It's definitely not as difficult as it may seem to get involved within your community. Attend a Black Lives Matter event. The first thing that I would recommend in terms of, you know, someone who wants to get involved within the Black Lives Matter movement is to just go on Facebook and find a local chapter that is a Black Lives Matter organization and to just reach out to the leaders, because we are anxiously needing much more people to get involved. And pretty sure a couple of your listeners would definitely be the ones to, you know, to help the movement move forward in a sense. But that's my last word, I guess, that I would give in terms of, you know, being active and getting starting that activism route.
Well, Elsa, it was a pleasure having you on our show today. I'm pretty sure that you will be back because you are a spokesperson for several movements. So thank you very much for being with us. And we'll see you here again sometime in the near future.
Oh, thank you guys so much for having me, both at the panel and this. I'm really, really grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, we're glad you had the time to share with us, and we wish you great luck with whatever your next project is. We ran out of time to discuss what's next on your plate, which gives us a reason to have you back. Keep up the great work. We sending good vibes your way. Good luck with all that in your area.
Definitely sending back good vibes to you. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
You can support Move to Amend reports and other Move to Amend programs by joining our $28 for the 28th Amendment monthly sustainer campaign. Pledge $28 a month and help make the We the People Amendment our 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Visit movetoamend.org/donate to sign up.
To learn more about corporate personhood, money as protected political speech, and how to get involved with Move to Amend, visit movetoamend.org. Don't forget to sign the petition and join over 400,000 people supporting the We the People Amendment at movetoamend.org/motion. You can also text the word sign to 707-656-4019.
Tune in next week when we talk with United We Dream's Amber Pinto about the movement for immigrants' rights, the current immigration and deportation rates, and the intersections between immigration rights and democracy. So please join us.
And that's it for this edition of Move to Amend Reports. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Move to Amend Reports was created and brought to you by Move to Amend. Produced by national team members Keon Bliss, Laura Bonham, Egberto Willis, and Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, with the assistance of Renee Babcock, and with contributions from Move to Amend staff and affiliates. Opening theme entitled Move to Amend, performed by Shimako Noble and produced by Soul Circuitry.